We are glad to make all of our JCast Network podcasts free for our listeners. However, they are not free to produce and host. Please consider making a donation to JCast Network to help support our work by visiting jcastnetwork.org/donate. Thanks for your support. You are listening to Pop Torah with Rabbi Znopf and Olitsky, a JCast Network podcast. For more information about other JCast Network podcasts, please visit jcastnetwork.org.
Welcome to Pop Torah, the podcast where we look at Judaism through the lens of pop culture and pop culture through the lens of Judaism. As always, we're your hosts. I am Rabbi Jesse Olitsky.
And I'm Rabbi Michael Knopf.
And today we're talking about the Apple TV Plus miniseries Manhunt, based on James Swanson's book Manhunt, The 12-Day Chase for Lincoln's Killer. The show focuses on the search for John Wilkes Booth following Lincoln's assassination. Mike, you want to tell us about the show?
Sure. Yeah. So like you said, the show based on the book of the same title just came out on Apple TV Plus a few weeks ago. We are now, as of this recording, four episodes in. I've seen three. The fourth episode just dropped today, so I'm looking forward to watching it this weekend. But as you said, Jesse, the show follows the hunt for John Wilkes Booth, the famed assassin of Abraham Lincoln. And in the process, it tells a story of Lincoln's evolving vision of what the understanding of what the Civil War was about, his ultimate embrace of emancipation and equal citizenship for Black Americans, and his vision for reconstructing the Union following the war that was created in conjunction with his Secretary of War, Edwin Stanton, played by in the show by Tobias Menzies, and several other members of Lincoln's cabinet, his famed team of rivals. Although the cabinet, the team of rivals thing is a little bit of a misnomer, at least in terms of who we focus on in this show. Edwin Stanton and William Seward, the Secretary of State, who were really Lincoln's closest confidants and his partners in kind of shaping the strategy and direction of the Civil War and what the country was going to look like after the Union ultimately won the war. Shortly after General Robert E. Lee surrenders to General Ulysses Grant at Appomattox Courthouse in 1865, Lincoln.
It's on the eve of Pesach, in case you're wondering. It was the day before the first Seder in 1865.
We're going to get many of those factoids over the course of this podcast, I think, from Rabbi Olitsky, drawing from Jonathan Sarna's book.
Yes, Jonathan Sarna. And it's Jonathan Sarna and Benjamin Chappelle, Lincoln and the Jews, A History.
Okay.
Looking forward to sharing that history.
That's right. Lincoln himself was not Jewish, though. Am I right about that?
He was not Jewish. He was very knowledgeable when it comes to what Christians call the Old Testament. It's what we call the Tanakh.
Right. And anyway, so the show really focuses on what Lincoln and Stanton and Seward were planning when it came to reconstructing the Union after Lee's surrender at Appomattox, and the efforts of people within and outside the federal government to undermine that plan and essentially restore the pre-war status quo, maybe minus official slavery, but for some people, maybe even including it. So the war, and which the show I think dramatizes really powerfully, was still being fought after Lee's surrender. It frames Lincoln's assassination. So Lincoln goes to see a show at Ford's Theater, famously a comedy show. Soon after Lee's surrender,
the performance was Our American Cousin,
right? And he, you know, wants to take his mind off of the troubles of the war and the stress of thinking about Reconstruction, and as a way of celebrating. Right. But John Wilkes Booth, who was a famous actor at the time, was able to slip past security of Ford's Theater, which also is dramatized really interestingly in the series Manhunt, and assassinates Lincoln, jumps on the stage, shouting "Sic Semper Tyrannis," "Death to Tyrants," which is people will note. The slogan on the flag of the state in which I reside, the Commonwealth of Virginia. Virginia, of course, plays an important role in the story of Civil War and Reconstruction. Virginia and the city that is now the capital of Virginia and where I live was also for most of the history.
That's Richmond, for those of our listeners who are unaware.
I was about to say the name of the city. The city of Richmond was the capital of the Confederate States, not the original capital of the Confederates, the Confederacy, but for most of the history of the Confederacy, the capital. The main army of the South that fought in the Civil War was General Lee's Army of Northern Virginia. Virginia is an important part of this story as well. We'll get into that, I imagine. Booth assassinates Lincoln, jumps on the stage, shouts "Sic Semper Tyrannis," breaks his leg doing it, but manages to escape. Is treated by a doctor sympathetic to the Confederacy, Dr. Mudd, in Maryland. So he flees north, but then eventually needs to make his way south, or wants to make his way south, is trying to get back to Richmond.
Dr. Mudd, by the way, played beautifully by Matt Walsh of Veep fame.
Veep fame, that's right. What Booth does not realize is that Richmond at the time is a smoldering ruin, and everyone from the Confederate leadership has fled Richmond in all sorts of different directions. So that will play out over the course of the series as well, as where Booth is going to go, how he's going to get there, and how he's ultimately caught. So, like I said, we are now just four episodes in. I'm not positive how many episodes the show is scheduled to be. The series is scheduled to be.
Maybe seven.
Okay, I was going to say, because it's a 12-day chase, maybe it's 12 episodes. But so we're about halfway through then. I've seen now three episodes. Jesse, you've seen a little bit less, but tell me what you've thought of Manhunt so far.
Yeah, some of it is history that I did not know. I did not realize the levels of conspiracy that went on. My own lack of Jewish history education, I guess, in high school made me believe that Booth was a bit of a lone gunman. Now the conspiracies are rolling, much like we're taught that Lee Harvey Oswald is. Now I'm second guessing the JFK assassination. But it's clear here that John Wilkes Booth was a part of a much larger plan. He, when hearing Lincoln's last public address, this is at least what history tells us, which dealt with Reconstruction. He was young, he was an actor, but he was very much pro-slavery. He was determined that that would be Lincoln's last speech. But it's clear, based on all those who helped hide Booth and try to save Booth and help sort of Booth with the assassination and what followed, Booth was far from a lone wolf here. He was part of a greater plan and conspiracy to assassinate President Lincoln and really to stop Reconstruction.
Right. You know, I was and am something of an American history buff. I was an American history major in college, and in fact, primarily focusing on the Civil War and Reconstruction. But I don't remember ever reading or learning about, and I didn't read the book Manhunt. So I wasn't exposed to it there. That may have been, you know, kind of revelatory research that was presented, because I don't remember ever learning or reading that aspect of the history that Booth was. It makes perfect sense, right? That he was, you know, in league with a number of folks, both from the, you know, Confederate leadership and spy network, along with moneyed interests. That's an aspect of the history of the you know, the period of human enslavement and the Civil War that I did know a bit about. The involvement powerful moneyed interests in this country and around the world in slavery, their support of the system of slavery because it financially benefited them. And they allude to this in the show, which is true historically, that there was a movement, an almost successful movement for New York City to secede from the Union and join the Confederacy, in part because of Wall Street's deep ties to you know, Southern agriculture and the slave system that supported it. So Lincoln,
right, it's not just about discrimination. It's not just about racism. It's not just about the racial injustice that is deeply a part of the fabric of the establishment of our nation, as slavery very much was. Right. It's, yes, seeing people of color as less than and being enslaved people. But as you said, Mike, it was very much about free labor. And in the words of Lin-Manuel Miranda's Hamilton, I believe it's in Cabinet Battle 1, maybe Cabinet Battle 2. He said, "Y'all don't pay for labor."
That's right. So and we, you know, it's, I think, commonplace to, you know, think about the Civil War. Although it's, you know, contested in places like where I live, that the Civil War was about preserving slavery, but about the South desiring to, which is true. But we often think about that as, okay, you know, like the Southern big landholders, the aristocracy of the South, the plantation owners were, you know, drove the South to secede, and certainly that's true. I mean, that's not that's a major part of it. But we, I think, ignore the reality that so much of the country was involved in, tied to, implicated in the system of slavery, both in the South and in the North. And so therefore, also when the war ended, many people, both in the South and in the North, you know, wanted to return to sort of the pre-war status quo, where there was, you know, legalized inequality and the capacity for economic exploitation of Black bodies, and maybe the restoration of enslavement, but certainly the forgiving of, you know, those both landowning and moneyed interests to kind of, you know, reset the table that way. But I didn't quite piece together that Booth's action was intimately tied in and that implicated all, you know, many other actors besides Booth. I also didn't quite realize just how famous Booth was at the time. As an actor. I certainly was famous after the assassination, but before the assassination, I knew he was an actor. I knew he was somewhat well known, right? But the show at least depicts him, maybe the book too, depicts him as, you know, a pretty well known and famous actor, renowned for his fight scenes. So it's, you know, it's like if Keanu Reeves assassinated the president. You know, is like fame, not like in the highest echelons of fame. And you know, very well, or maybe, I don't know, maybe Jackie Chan or something like that, right? Assassinated the president. It's just like, it's crazy. It's inconceivable on some level to think that, you know, something like that would happen. But of course did. You know, I also.
So you're saying we should not invite Jackie Chan to the White House?
No. I think Jackie Chan is appears to be a lovely guy. I would, you know, love to hang out with Jackie Chan. I'm not saying he's a threat to the country. I'm just saying we should be suspicious of everybody, you know, who's famous.
Those actors.
You can never trust them, except for friends of the pod, Jonathan McClain, and Erica Wax. Okay, but and the other piece that I didn't quite know from the history is that Edwin Stanton, who was the Secretary of War, which, you know, an office that we now call Secretary of Defense, because it's not a War Department anymore, of course. That he personally spearheaded the investigation and hunt for Booth. It may be over dramatized in the show, just how involved he was, but maybe not. And even if he was very involved on a personal level in the manhunt, even to not extent the show is saying, that's pretty wild to think about. If you think about, you know, a cabinet level secretary, you know, being involved in, you know, if you can imagine, like, Merrick Garland, you know, like personally hunting down January 6th insurrectionists. It's a little bit unfathomable given our bureaucracy at this point. But actually, that may be a good place to start, Jesse, because one of the
Well,
things that the
it's also, I'll just add, it's also deeply problematic because history tells us that Lincoln himself had a deep tension with some of his top generals during the Civil War, with some cabinet secretaries. And so when you have the Secretary of War responsible for the manhunt of John Wilkes Booth, you often wonder how genuine that search is.
Right. Yes, exactly. You know, listen, I think that that Stanton and Lincoln, at least as depicted by the show, is not is not among the people that Lincoln had most conflict and tension with. That their conflict, you know, insofar as they had it, was productive and friendly conflict, certainly mutually respectful conflict. But that Stanton was a close ally of Lincoln, you know, throughout the war. So Lincoln quarreled with and fired several of his generals in the war. But did not fire Stanton, you know, during the course of the Civil War. You know, remained his war secretary throughout. But I think that, you know, there is something, you know, there's a, I think it's an episode two or three, where it depicts a scene of Lincoln and Stanton before the assassination, before when it looks pretty clear that the South is going to surrender, talking about what Reconstruction is going to look like. And Lincoln was arguing a position of, you know, of forgiveness and restoration to Confederate leadership. And, you know, it kind of echoes what he said in his second inaugural address, you know, with malice toward none and with charity for all.
Which, by the way, we can't overemphasize how deeply humble that is, and how it goes against our basic human instinct, right? That he's not in search of revenge. He's not in, right? That he wants to move on together. There's something I actually believe deeply Jewish about that idea. Of, you know, allowing people to do tshuva and that being enough, and instead of focusing on consequences and sort of holding people with this sort of long-term guilt that they may have.
Yeah, I want to think about that for a moment, because Stanton argues, you know, Lincoln says about that, he says, you know, like, let the sheep flee, right? We won, let the sheep flee. And Stanton says, you know, these aren't sheep, these are wolves. And if you let wolves go back out into the wild, they're going to come back and attack you. So I want to interrogate that a little bit, Jesse, from a Jewish perspective, because, you know, of course, first of all, the declaration of amnesty or forgiveness, or, you know, charity toward transgressors, especially when you are not the one most directly impacted by their actions, their crimes, right? So, starting with the people who had been held as slaves for several hundred years by the perpetrators of the crime, as well as their ancestors, the severe disadvantage that those people were at following the war, especially if their oppressors were let off, right? So it is, in some way, extremely praiseworthy, Lincoln's approach there, and even I agree with you. There is something quite Jewish about it, and at the same time, it does lack, it feels to me, a certain sense of truth and justice that is required in the process of tshuva. And I think that the challenge is, you know, and this is what Stanton points out, right? That they're wolves. You can't just let wolves go, right? You have to chain the wolves up or kill them, right? Make them neutralize their threat. Ensure that you're neutralizing their threat, or else they're going to attack again. And certainly after, you know, Lincoln came around to that perspective, he was, he ended up advocating a much more radical plan for Reconstruction than he originally conceived of. But a plan that was ultimately, not carried out, once Lincoln's successor is Vice President Andrew Johnson, who is, right. Who's depicted in the show, also, I think, really, powerfully, Johnson, who was a Tennessean, not a secessionist, not necessarily a Confederate sympathizer, but certainly a rabid racist, that Johnson did not want to have a radical Reconstruction plan, a punitive Reconstruction plan. He wanted to sort of like get back to normalcy and kind of restore the economy of the country, right? And I think the problem with that,
Andrew Johnson, by the way, in the show, played by Glenn Morshower, who was Agent Pierce in 24, for all you 24 fans out there.
It's so funny, because when I was watching the show with my wife, I said, you know, it would have been really great had they done this show like 24, you know, like done it in real time.
Yeah.
Right? Like, would have been great. Cause I keep on like wanting Edwin Stanton to say, we're running out of time, but he doesn't yet. or at least not quite like that. So, anyway, my point with all this is, I think that the history, the post-Civil War history of this country, points to a truth that's present in the laws and traditions around tshuva and Judaism, that if people don't actually make proper amends, if they don't do the work necessary, if they don't have the consequences imposed on them that remind them the severity of their actions, that they are just as likely to do those things again in the future. If they aren't given like the real impetus for an opportunity for true tshuva, they're likely to do it again. And beyond that, it shows other people that, you know, it's okay to do what they did, because you're not going to get punished for it.
There's a deeply problematic, I would say, not far-fetched connection between that and the world that we're currently living in. When we talk about the January 6th insurrectionists, When we talk about the desire for Trump, part of his plan for being, if he is to be reelected, is to make sure that all those who are in prison and have served prison sentences for their role in the January 6th insurrection of the Capitol, to not be held accountable, frankly, for him to not be held accountable. And that's deeply, I would say, problematic, specifically problematic. And it just goes to show you that these conversations that are being had in the show, and that history is very much alive and well, because some of it, I don't want to suggest that we're at a time of civil war. Although, by the way, there is a new movie coming out, Civil War, coming out in April. I don't know if you've seen trailers for that, talking about what a modern day civil war would look like, God forbid. I think there is a deep sense that we are more divided as a country than we've ever been before. I don't know if that's true, or it's just that there's always been sort of a deep division of two parties. I don't know if it just feels like each party has gone further to its, you know, to the polls, P-O-L-E-S, right? That they are further to the right, further to the left. And so there's that sense. And God forbid we get to the sense the reality of the 1860s, right, where there was, you know, the Civil War and battles and lives lost. But there is certainly a sense from a belief and ideology perspective that we are divided and we are two separate ideologies of what America should be. What will come of that, God forbid, is to be seen. But we have this battle of whether or not somebody's held accountable for their actions. And is it enough, right, if they do tshuva, right? Where it's unclear with what happened following the Civil War, if tshuva was done, certainly by the John Wilkes Booths of the world, they weren't ready to surrender. They weren't ready to wave the white flag like Robert E. Lee did. They were still fighting. The January 6th insurrectionists, they refused to believe that the election was legitimate, and they were still fighting, partially encouraged by Donald Trump to say, fight. This was fake and flawed, and this election was rigged. So it's about accepting reality, and if you refuse to do so, then should you be held more accountable for your transgressions than if you accept what you did and take accountability for your actions.
Right. And I think you're right. I mean, I think that in many ways we are still fighting the Civil War, just in different forms. Even as literally as, you know, the Supreme Court just took up a case about the provision of the 14th Amendment, which is maybe the most important of the Reconstruction Amendments, the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment, they're all important. 13th Amendment abolished slavery. The 14th Amendment did a number of things, including granting birthright citizenship, which was originally designed for the newly emancipated slaves to grant equal citizenship for those who were born in the country, but also was intended to bar Confederates, former Confederates, from holding office. But it says anybody who's engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the government. And you know, the Supreme Court took up the case about whether Donald Trump was disqualified from appearing on the ballot for the presidency on the grounds of the 14th Amendment, did not dispute that he was an insurrectionist, but declined to bar him from the ballot. Which struck me, and I think many others, as a profound act of cowardice on the part of the Supreme Court in the desire to, you know, kind of maintain civility and the veneer of impartiality in electoral politics. They essentially played with something quite dangerous, which is enabling and emboldening somebody who tried to violently overthrow the government to be a coin toss away from being the next leader of the government. It's a very, and the, you know, the issues that animate so much of the MAGA movement are the issues that animated the former Confederacy, white supremacy, white power, the power of capital over labor, et cetera, et cetera, right? The prioritization of Christianity over other faiths, or you name it. So if you look at the Electoral College map, it's a little bit different than the maps of the Civil War, and things change, you know, here and there. But primarily the electoral politics, national electoral politics nowadays still essentially fall along the lines of the old Union and the old Confederacy. Former slave states now overwhelmingly vote Republican, and former free states now overwhelmingly vote Democrat. With some rare exceptions from time to time. Virginia, it goes back and forth between being a red state and a blue state. Georgia now goes back and forth between a red state and a blue state.
So much of that has to do with the change during the Civil Rights Act, right?
That's LBJ. But that in and of itself is deeply tied to the history of Civil War and Reconstruction, right? Because the Jim Crow regime of the South was imposed essentially immediately after the end of Reconstruction, which was already in itself a product of what was known as a corrupt bargain in a presidential election that included the promise to remove federal troops from the former Confederate states. So almost immediately after federal troops were removed from the South and Reconstruction officially ended, the former slaveholding aristocracy moved to establish a system of legalized apartheid in the South and in the Jim Crow regime, and moved to retell the story of the Confederacy as a lost cause for the glory of the South and for states' rights and freedom. And so you have, like, as was the case in my city in Richmond, a wave of monuments being erected glorifying leaders of the Confederacy to tell a story about the Civil War that perpetuated and lionized the ideals for which they fought without naming them explicitly as the ideals for which they fought, right? So it sort of reminded the formerly enslaved, who was really in charge, and what the values of those states were. So that's an issue that we're still grappling with, right? In Richmond, as with a lot of places in the country, there was a reckoning with that lost cause iconography in the wake of the first, I think, in the wake of the shootings at Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston, South Carolina, when we had a big reckoning over the Confederate battle flag, which led, I think, New Orleans to take down some of its Confederate monuments, which I think was the first major city to do so. And then in the George Floyd protests of 2020, that was the big movement. In Richmond, it was very, very heated, very intense conversations around that. Some of the monuments were actually physically toppled by Black Lives Matter's protesters during the summer of 2020. But ultimately, it led to the removal of all Confederate monuments, lost cause, monuments in the city. But what nothing was put up to replace them. They were just kind of paved over, or they put landscaping, and there's now going to be a sort of garden in the former Lee Circle on Monument Avenue in Richmond, which is essentially doing what Stanton was arguing to Lincoln not to do in Manhunt, which is, you know, don't just try to move on, because it's going, if you don't actually make people confront the reality and brutality of the history, we are likely going to keep reliving it and relitigating it. And I think that is, I worry that that's going to happen in Richmond. I mean, that happened, during the Jim Crow regime. Richmond paved, not only erected Lost Cause iconography, but literally paved over places that were reminders of the brutality of slavery, including an area in Richmond known as the Devil's Half Acre, which was where Richmond's slave market was, and other facilities like a slave jail. And Richmond had the second largest slave market in the country after the closing of the international slave trade earlier in the 19th century. And the Jim Crow leadership of Richmond made a deliberate choice to pave that over so people wouldn't have to confront the brutality of their history. And without doing that, it gives license to emboldens those who essentially want us to forget that history because it doesn't serve their interests. So this is all, I think, part of the question of Tshuva that the show really brings up, is, you know, how important is it to have a real confrontation, a truthful confrontation with one's history, in order to, you know, really do tshuva and constructively move forward.
You know, and especially because, right, the root of the word tshuva is to return, right? So what are we returning? Are we meant to return to a state of purity? Are we able to do that if we have not made amends, if we have not... Nezikin in the Mishnah talks about financial restitution for damage caused, for harm done. If we're not able to fully, you can't make it as if it didn't happen, but we can do our part to repair the fractures that we've created. I think about how you made a really good point about Richmond literally paving over aspects of the city that told the more challenging parts of our history. We just had Shabbat Zahor, right? We just had the Shabbat, which is intentionally the Shabbat immediately before Purim, because in Shabbat Zahor, we read about Amalek, and we're taught that Haman was a descendant of the Amalekites. And I think about that text where we read that about the Amalekites, and we're told that we should both remember and erase their memory, right? We should erase their memory, but not forget. And it's the balance of not letting the weight of history prevent us from moving forward, not letting the burden of history prevent us from moving forward. I appreciate, right, Lincoln's desire for Reconstruction to say, we're going to move forward together as one, and you're not going to be, and future generations are not going to be liable for the sins of their ancestors. But we can't forget that history, and we need to tell that history, which, as you pointed out, right, this show tells a part of history that was new to both of us with regards to the search for Booth. If we don't tell that history, then history will repeat itself. And we're seeing that on a very different level with, you know, January 6th, with the way insurrectionists are trying to be freed. I want to highlight in the couple of minutes we have left, if it's okay, just to highlight from Jonathan Sarna and Benjamin Chappelle's book, Lincoln and the Jews, because so much of Lincoln's work that he focused on with regards to equality and banning slavery, outlawing slavery in the country, is also just about his idea of equality in general. That in the early 19th century, that's when you saw this sort of large-scale immigration, the first large-scale immigration of Jews, mostly from Central Europe, into the country. And many in America began, you know, we talk about Washington's letter, you know, to Toro Synagogue, and we say, oh, this is a sign that Jews were meant to be equal. But there weren't a ton of Jews, right, in the late 1700s in this country. In the early 1800s, when you saw a wave of Jews immigrating to America, Jews began being treated as second-class citizens in the country. And due to some of the influence of some of Lincoln's presidential campaign advisors, that sort of thing, he quickly tried to change the language. And you saw this in the speeches he gave. Previously, the language that was used, and this is, by the way, language that Trump is trying to go back to, some of the MAGA enthusiasts is going back to, is that America is a Christian nation. Right, we talk about freedom from religion. We talk about separation of church and state. The language that was used up until Lincoln was that America was a Christian nation. And the language that was used after Lincoln was that America is a nation under God, which I think is, and that's right. That's the language we use. One nation under God, indivisible, for liberty and justice for all, right? That he tried very hard to bring equity and equality to Jews in this country in the mid-1800s when he was president. And that shouldn't be overthought. I mean, listen, Jews were second-class citizens, but they weren't enslaved like people of color were, taken from their homes and put on slave ships and brought to this country. I just want to highlight that his work for making a more just society in America was for many in society, because of his role in bringing an end to the Civil War and an end to slavery, some of his relationship with the Jewish community in America gets overlooked, and that's something that Sarna and Chappella really highlight in their book.
Yeah, it's a really great point, and I think that, you know, when Lincoln talks about Christianity, and even, you know, when he thought of or employed that language of a Christian nation, ultimately transitioning it to one nation under God, that he didn't necessarily mean the supremacy of one religious group over another. He meant you know, the sort of ideals of Christianity, including, you know, charity and justice and forgiveness and equality under the law, which he saw as, you know, Christian ideals. We actually have this conversation in Jewish community quite a bit of, you know, is Judaism, you know, a parochial religion particularistic religion about the Jews and the well-being of the Jews. And so when we talk about Judaism, do we have in mind, you know, something very particularistic? Or when we talk about Judaism, do we talk about essentially like a framework for more universal values? So if I were to call, like, when I think of Israel as a Jewish state, I think on some level, it's, you know, the ideal of it is supposed to be both of those things, right? Both a state for the Jews and a state that's informed by Jewish values. And I think that's a difference between Lincoln and some of his predecessors and now some of his successors in office. And the other piece of it, which I think is really powerful, and I think that this is part of Lincoln's greatness, is he did have, I think, a real sense of faith and humility in faith of what, you know, what a country was and what a leader of a country was, that he was not the supreme authority, economic interest, the interests of power, whatever it is, are not the ultimate authority, that God is the ultimate. So when we say one nation under God, you know, what we're saying is that we serve something greater than ourselves, that we are responsive and responsible to something greater than our own self-interests.
Do you think that also comes from his deep humility, that he actually lost many elections many times, and it was actually quite a surprise when he got his party's presidential nomination?
Yeah, the whole story of him getting the party's presidential nomination and his rise to power is a really, really powerful one. And in fact, Ezra Klein has argued, the columnist for the New York Times has argued recently that the Democrats should be thinking about the process that led to Lincoln's election nomination rather in for the election of 1860 and like open convention process. But it could be. He also lost a child at a young age. And you know, grew up of relatively modest means. The mythology of the log cabin and things like that are a little bit not totally accurate. But he was not born into aristocracy like many of his predecessors in office. So I think he did have a core sense of humility and a recognition that, you know, even in the most powerful office in the land, he was not the ultimate authority, right? He might have said, you know, the people are the ultimate authority, but that ultimately, right, everybody is under God's dominion. I was just studying with some folks in my congregation, the prophet Ovadia, Obadiah, who famously uses the phrasing, you know, ki ladonai hamlucha, right? For sovereignty is God's, something that we repurpose when we say Aleinu every day. The Aleinu prayer, we say ki al malchut shalchahi, right? For dominion is yours, God, right? And so I think that is the sense of our tradition, that we ought to recognize the limitations of human power and the imperative of service over our own sort of arrogant and self-interested desires.
Well, we're interested to hear from you if you're watching Manhunt on Apple TV Plus, and if you're not, go ahead and watch it and let us know your thoughts. Spoiler alert. They eventually catch John Wilkes Booth, eventually dies. Spoiler alert, the North wins the Civil War, and Lincoln is assassinated. But besides that, how'd you like to play Mrs. Lincoln?
Right. But I would say, you know, what the show is, I think, kind of alluding to is that, yes, the North technically won the Civil War, but did they ultimately win the battle for the soul of the country? And perhaps not. Perhaps that's a battle that we're still fighting.
We're still fighting. Good point. Well, until next time, I am Rabbi Jesse Olitsky.
And with malice toward none and with charity for all, in firmness as in the right as God gives us to see the right. 47 years ago, I'm Rabbi Michael Knopf.
You have a bit of a Lincoln beard.
Thank you very much for saying that. It's because my mustache, it comes in light.
Also, you have his height.
I know. I just wish I could pull off the stovepipe hat.
Yeah, well, there are shuls that the chazanim and rabbis used to do that on the high holidays. It's time to bring it back.
I'm looking to bring it back. Maybe the show will start to make that in vogue again.
Take care, everyone.
Bye.